Hello everyone, this is Jane Holmes and the Whitney Talking News magazine team with a special tribute to all those people who took part in World War I, World War II and D-Day. This year, 2014, reminds us all it is 100 years since the beginning of World War I. My fellow team members for this magazine include our recordists, Nick Wiggins, Eric Imeson and Graham Diacon. Our readers include Anne Crawford, Debbie Diacon, Catherine Kennedy, Fenella Pearson, Alan Bailey, Roger Batley, Peter B., Peter Brading, David Burton, Richard Rayson, and our new team member, Mike Day. We have all made contributions to the magazine. Historical facts, poetry, memories both personal and from other people, music and interviews are all included. Music has been especially performed for us by Leslie Morris and Keith Harris of Voicebox. We have interviews from people who have special wartime memories to share with us. One interesting interview comes from a past Whitney Talking News listener, Mr. Terry Harper. Now, wartime always brings with it sadness and hardship for all involved. However, in this magazine, I hope you will see it brings communities together as they strive to find hope and happiness for future years. To begin our tribute, Anne and Roger will explain how and why World War I ever began at all.
The beginning of World War I in 1914. Britain declared war on Germany on the 4th of August 1914, following the German advance through Belgium, an essential part of the German plan to conquer France. For the first 6 weeks of the war, German troops swept towards Paris. The British Expeditionary Force, sent to Belgium to halt them and facing the Germans at Mons, was driven back more than 100 miles, together with the French forces, to the River Marne, less than 40 miles from Paris. On September the 8th, the British and French troops on the Marne halted the German advance and began to push the Germans back. The race was then on to reach the Channel and North Sea ports. On September the 11th, after spending 24 hours examining the defences at Dunkirk, Churchill spoke to an anxious audience at the London Opera House. His words, widely reported in the newspapers, encouraging his troops and his audience, he said,
"We meet here together in serious times, but I come to you tonight in good heart and with good confidence for the future and for the task upon which we are engaged."
Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey was in a more sombre mood. He declared,
"The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime."
As Britain went to war with Germany, the whole country was swept up into a wave of patriotism. Everyone wanted to do their bit and become involved before this brief campaign ended. It was sure to be over by Christmas, or so it was said. There now follows a few experiences from people of all walks of life, some of which you may remember yourselves happening.
Private S.C. Lang. I was walking down the Camden High Street when two young ladies approached and said, "Why aren't you in the army with the boys?" So I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm only 17. And one of them said, "Oh, we've heard that one before. I suppose you're also doing work of national importance." Then she put her hand in her bag and pulled out a feather. I raised a hand, thinking she was going to strike me, and this feather was pushed up my nose. Then a sergeant came out of one of the shops and said to me, "Did she call you a coward?" I said yes, and felt very indignant about it. He said, "Well, come across the road to the drill hall, and we'll soon prove that you aren't a coward." I got into the drill hall, and then the sergeant said to me, "How old are you?" I told him I was 17, and he said, "What did you say? 19? "No, 17. "When were you born?"
1898.
1896?
"No," I said, 1898. He then said to me,
"Get on the scales."
He weighed me, took my height, and said,
"Now we'll go round to the doctor for a medical exam."
The doctor told me to take off all my clothes, which embarrassed me very much. At any rate, I got back to the drill hall, where there were six of us waiting, and the sergeant called out my name. I walked forward and thought, "Oh, that's good, I'm not in." And he said,
"You're the only so-and-so that's passed out of this six."
I was astonished, because I had told him I was only 17, and there I was, almost in the army. I went to the recruiting office, and the officer said something to me about king and country, and then he said,
"Well, raise your right hand and say I will," or something like that. Then he said, "I'm extremely sorry I haven't got your shilling, but we'll let you have that later on."
And to my amazement, I found I was being called Private S.C. Lang.
A Norwich Hero. This is the story of some of the actions of my father, Corporal Sidney James Day, during the First World War, as told by an article printed in a Norwich newspaper in 1917 after he was awarded the Victoria Cross, and includes a letter he wrote home to his parents telling them of the award. He joined up in 1914 and after 12 months training was sent with the 9th Battalion Suffolk Regiment to France, which took part in the Battle of Loos. The fighting was very severe, and this is where his courage was first displayed. His platoon became detached from the main body and presently found that he was the only uninjured man in the platoon. He spotted his officer, who was badly wounded, and picked him up and proceeded to carry him to a place of safety when a sniper killed the officer. It was 3 days before my father regained his battalion. As a sign of their gratitude, the parents of Lieutenant T.T. Stevens presented my father with an inscribed silver cigarette case dated 26 September 1915. On this same day, a VC was won by another member of the Suffolk Regiment, a Sergeant Saunders. The fighting at this time was continuous, but the next event that my father was involved in was the Battle of the Somme in 1916. Here he narrowly escaped losing his life, sustaining no fewer than 4 bullet wounds on different parts of his body. One struck him directly over the heart, but he had in his breast pocket 2 or 3 notebooks, a packet of postcards and about a dozen field cards. It passed through the lot, was deflected and came out through his back. Another struck him near the groin but became embedded in a rangefinder leather case and only caused a bruise. A third passed through his thigh and came out of his groin, and the fourth went through his left side and came out of his back. With these wounds, he laid in a shower hole from 7 a.m. until dark, when he crept 3 miles to a dressing station. During this offensive, the colonel of the battalion was killed. In due course, my father was returned to Blighty, and he was sent to the Norfolk War Hospital, where he made a wonderful recovery from his wounds, and after 2 months, then to a convalescent home. Early in 1917, he went again to France, this time with the 11th Battalion Suffolk Regiment, and took part in the Third Battle of Ypres. On the afternoon of Sunday, 26th of August 1917, at Malakoff Farm near Hagecourt, my father displayed the conspicuous bravery that won him his VC. On the 4th of September, he wrote a letter to his parents as follows. "In about 6 weeks' time, you should be informed of great news, which will make you the proudest parents in Norwich. I am recommended for the Victoria Cross, the first one in this battalion up to the present. I shall be able to tell you more about it when I come home, and I am sure it cannot be a greater surprise to you than it has been to me. Last Sunday week, August 26, we went over to the attack. Everything went off successful, thanks to God's mercy and care. I came through untouched. When we got back to our billets, my platoon officer told me that he was very pleased with what I had done in the attack and was recommending me for an award. The colonel came to my billet and said, "Corporal, I have come to congratulate you on the splendid work you did last Sunday. I am very pleased and proud of you. When it comes in orders, I will return to dear old Blighty to receive my medal. There are several decorations to be given in the battalion, and the recommendations have gone through, and I hope they will be granted. We have about 4 DCMs, several MMs, and in our company, my VC. Above all, I have my officer to thank for his recommendation, as he seems to think I am worthy of what I am to get and says I have earned it. The citation, as published in the London Gazette on 17th of October 1917, reads as follows. For most conspicuous bravery, Corporal Day was in command of a bombing section detailed to clear a maze of trenches still held by the enemy. This he did, killing 2 machine gunners and taking 4 prisoners. On reaching a point where the trench had been levelled, he went alone and bombed his way through to the left in order to gain touch with the neighbouring troops. Immediately on his return to his section, a stick bomb fell into the trench occupied by 2 officers, of which 1 was badly wounded, and 3 other ranks. Corporal Day seized the bomb and threw it over the trench, where it immediately exploded. This prompt action undoubtedly saved the lives of those in the trench. He afterwards completed the clearing of the trench and established himself in an advanced position, remained for 66 hours at his post, which came under intense hostile shell and rifle grenade fire. Throughout the whole operation, his conduct was an inspiration to all. My father returned to England for the presentation of his medal at Buckingham Palace by the King and was proudly accompanied by his parents. He returned once again to France and within 2 days, on the 9th of April 1918, was wounded and captured. He remained as a prisoner of war until repatriation on the 23rd of December 1918.
Breakfast by Wilfred Gibson. We ate our breakfast lying on our backs because the shells were screeching overhead. I bet a rasher to a loaf of bread that Hull United would beat Halifax when Jimmy Stainthorpe played full back instead of Billy Bradford. Ginger raised his head and cursed and took the bet and dropped back dead. We ate our breakfast lying on our backs because the shells were screeching overhead.
The article I'm about to read is taken from a booklet entitled Forgotten Voices of the Great War by Max Arthur. It gives us an insight into what it was like to do the arduous and sometimes dangerous job of working in a munitions factory. It was written by Mrs. M. Hall. I'd never been in a factory before, but the crisis made me think. I thought, well, my brothers and my friends are in France, and so a friend and I thought to ourselves, let us do something. So we wrote to London and asked for war work, and we were directed to a munitions factory at Perivale in London. We had to have a health examination because we have to be physically very fit, perfect eyesight and strong. We had to supply 4 references and be British-born of British parents. We worked 10 hours a day from 8 in the morning till 1:45 with no break. An hour for dinner, back again until 6:30, again with no break. We single girls found it very difficult to eat as well as work because the shops were closed when we got home. We had to do our work and try to get food, which was difficult. I remember going into a shop after not having milk for 7 days, and they said, "If you can produce a baby, you can have the milk." That was it. I went into a butcher's shop to get some meat because we were just beginning to be rationed, and I said, "That looks like cat." And he said, "It is." I couldn't face that. It was a perfect factory to work in. I mean, everybody seemed unaware of the powder around them, unaware of any danger. Once or twice we heard, "Oh, so-and-so's gone." Perhaps she'd made a mistake and her eye was out. But there wasn't any big explosion during the 3 years I was there. We worked at making these little pellets, very innocent-looking little pellets. But had there been the slightest bit of grit in them, it would have been goodbye.
Captain Herbert Sulzbach, German artillery. One summer evening, soon after the Battle of the Somme had started, the guns were rumbling and there was a terrible noise of battle in our ears. Yet where we lay, just 30 metres from the trenches, there were mountains and peace and hardly any shooting. We could see the French soldiers, and one night a Frenchman started to sing. He was a wonderful tenor. None of us dared shoot, and suddenly we were all looking out from the trenches and applauding, and the Frenchman said, "Merci." It was peace in the middle of war, and the strange thing was that just a few kilometres northwards, the terrible Battle of the Somme was going on.
So this is Marjorie Llewellyn, a schoolgirl in Sheffield. Very soon, we began to get the wounded arriving in the city from the Somme battle. The Teachers' Training College was turned into the 3rd Northern General Hospital and staffed by consultants from the other Sheffield hospitals. There were soldiers in some of the other general hospitals, of course, but there were far too many of them coming in to be taken by those alone. As you can imagine, when the men got to the stage of being able to walk around a little in their hospital blue, they were made much of and didn't lack for invitations out for tea. We were very, very proud of our boys.
A World War One memory. This year has seen many programmes and events to mark the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War. There are now no survivors left who fought in that war. But 50 years ago, in 1964, I was living in London and my father-in-law paid us a visit. The purpose of his visit was to attend a 50th anniversary regimental reunion to mark the outbreak of World War One. You see, he'd enlisted in 1914 and served right through that war until his demob in 1919. In the summer of 1914, he was living in a small Sussex village where he'd lived all his 24 years and where his family had lived for generations. He was employed as a gamekeeper on a local estate when war broke out, whereupon he enlisted in the Queen's Royal West Surrey Regiment. And after a period of training, he left for France in 1915 to be moved straight to the front line. During his war service, he fought in the battles of Loos, the Somme, Ypres, Vimy Ridge and Messines, rising to the rank of a signal sergeant and winning the military medal for a conspicuous act of gallantry, which he would never talk about. What a shock it must have been, moving from a quiet rural existence to the chaos of the trenches, the mud, the slaughter, and the constant noise of heavy gunfire. My father-in-law had invited me to accompany him to this reunion. We assembled at a memorial to the regiment in Hyde Park, and then went on to a nearby restaurant for a celebratory meal. At the memorial, there wasn't a dry eye when the last post was played. And my wife often used to say that although her father never talked about the war, he always had a tear in his eye on Remembrance Sunday. The reunion meal was remarkable and made a huge impression on me. Here were about 30 survivors, all in their 70s or 80s, who hadn't clapped eyes on one another for 45 years. greeting each other as old friends, handshakes, backslapping, and the exchange of nicknames. What they'd all gone through, and what sights they must have witnessed, I couldn't dream of. But every one of those old soldiers bore some kind of injury. There were some with an arm or a leg missing, several who were blind in one eye and wore an eye patch. Many had fingers missing, and I think that all of them were deaf in at least one ear. The constant noise during a bombardment must have been horrendous. Many still had shrapnel embedded in an arm, leg or neck. There was a meaningful and respectful 2 minute silence for absent comrades, whose names were probably engraved on war memorials in villages such as the one my father-in-law had heralded from. But generally, the meal took place in a very jovial and happy mood amongst a group of survivors who were glad to see old comrades again and rejoice in still being alive after the nightmare they'd all lived through from 1914 to 1918. And subsequently, I wondered how many of them might have identified with this verse from a poem by the war poet Siegfried Sassoon. Good morning, the general said, when we met him last week on our way to the line. Now the soldiers he smiled at are most of them dead, and were cursing his staff for incompetent swine. He's a cheery old card, grunted Harry to Jack, as they trudged up to Arras with rifles and pack. But he did for them both with his plan of attack.
Vimy Ridge. Vimy Ridge extends for almost 12 kilometres northeast of Arras. The Germans occupied the ridge in September 1914, and their engineers immediately began to construct a network of artillery-proof trenches and bunkers protected from attack by concrete machine gun posts. Repeated French attempts to take Vimy Ridge cost about 150,000 casualties in 1915. The British took over the Arras sector in early 1916, and in the winter of that year, the Canadian Corps, commanded by Lieutenant General Sir Julian Byng, replaced the British at Arras. The Battle of Vimy Ridge was part of the British Spring Offensive. Preparations for the battle had been going on for months. 5 kilometres of tunnels were dug in order to move Canadian troops and ammunition up to the front without their being seen by German observers. This was the first and last time that all four divisions of the Canadian Corps, about 100,000 men, attacked simultaneously. At 5:30 the next morning, 2,800 Allied guns began pounding the German trenches, and soon afterwards the Canadian infantry went over the top into no man's land, supported by a creeping barrage. Despite suffering heavy losses, the Canadians were in control of Vimy Ridge by the 12th of April. The Canadian Corps had lost 11,297 men killed. The capture of Vimy Ridge was a great tactical success.
The Trench of Death, Dyksmead. In October 1914, the Germans tried to reach French territory via a thrust across West Flanders. They wanted to close the Channel ports. The push came to an end at the Battle of Yser and by the deliberate flooding of the Yser Plain between Nieuport and Dyksmead. The Belgians started digging this trench in 1915 in order to retake a heavily defended machine gun base next to some petrol tanks. The digging had to take place without any protection and under heavy enemy fire. This was the most advanced post of Belgian defence and was the theatre of continuous and murderous fighting. Artillery and mortar shells, incessant alerts, heavy gunfire, unexpected grenades and sudden attacks continued for the rest of the war. A final successful offensive effort began on the morning of 28th September 1918.
Regimental Sergeant Major Arthur Harrington. Shivering in the cold, muddy trenches of the Western Front, Arthur Harrington took comfort amid the horrors of the First World War by writing to his loved ones back home in Britain. The regimental sergeant major went to the battlefields with the London Rifle Brigade in late 1914, leaving behind his pregnant wife Florence and young daughter Margaret. In a series of moving letters, he described the harsh life on the front line.
Freezing weather, lack of food and sleep, noise of the guns and the constant bombardment from German munitions.
But Sergeant Major Harrington managed to endure the risk to life and limb by thinking of his family. In one tender letter, dated March 1915, he wrote,
"You and my darling child are constantly in my thoughts. It is indeed a comfort to me always that your life during the last 3 years since we were happily united at the altar has been a happy one. God hope many happy days together are still in store for us. I crave for you so often, but must be like so many other men out here in being patient."
Tragically, a month later, and 2 weeks after celebrating the birth of his second child, the 46-year-old was killed by an exploding shell. He was buried in Ypres in the Manningate Cemetery.
Private Harold Robinson. Private Harold Robinson, who served with the London Regiment, arrived on the Western Front in April 1918. He wrote 125 letters to his sweetheart Jessie, who he would marry. He wrote,
"Since I've been with you, I've had some of the very best times of my life."
He also described what letters to soldiers in the trenches meant.
"What a great thing is a letter,"
he wrote.
"It works wonders and is far better than all medicines. When I saw your letter lying on my bed, all my troubles disappeared."
It is surprising that even in this day and age of communication being possible by so many different methods, that even today's soldiers still value the humble letter.
Grandad's War. For many years, I have been researching the history of my family tree. I started with my father's side of the family, and I would like to tell you about Grandad. Grandad was born in 1891 in a small rural village, and the occupations of most people were of agricultural nature. Farmers, wheelwrights, field workers, harvesters. Some of them were plate layers on the railway line being built between Malvern and Worcester. As a boy, Grandad attended the village school, and in the summertime, he and his friends helped put out the harvest and gathered in the crops. Grandad later became a carter boy, gently leading the horses across the field as the plough made straight furrows behind him for the next year's crop. In August 1914, Grandad was 23 years old, and like many of his companions, volunteered to join the army. He had no military experience or knowledge, but was keen to help out, to do his part. He joined the 11th Worcestershire Regiment, and he went on training courses in Warwickshire and Wiltshire before being sent to Boulogne from Folkestone. In September 1915, he found himself in the Somme Valley working on trench systems. By November, he was in Marseille and then Salonika, constructing defence systems around the town. In September 1916, he was involved with operations with Bulgaria, and during this, he was shot in the shoulder by gunfire or sniper fire. He received treatment in a hospital in Salonika, after which he returned to join his regiment. This was all so different from the gentle farmlands with which he was so familiar. Demobilisation came in 1919, and after the war, he became a member of Dudley Police Force. Here, he worked his way into the ranks and became Chief Inspector of Police, where he remained until his retirement. Sadly, I could not discover his service records, as they had been destroyed by bombs during World War II. He never spoke about the war. He never classified himself as any sort of hero. However, to me, he was and still is a hero, of whom I am very, very proud.
When I taught at Wood Green School, I was fortunate to join Year 10 history students on several occasions when they visited Ypres as part of their research on the First World War. One of the places that we visited was Essex Farm Cemetery and the advanced dressing station where John McCrae reportedly wrote his famous poem in May 1915. Walking back up the lane from the row of shelters and dugouts used by the wounded, we could see clearly the fields of red poppies and take time to think about what happened there 100 years ago. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Dead Man's Penny. The history of the Dead Man's Penny began in 1916 with the realisation by the British government that some form of official token of gratitude should be given to the fallen servicemen and women's bereaved next of kin. The enormous casualty figures, not anticipated at the start of World War I, prompted this gesture of recognition. In 1917, the government announced a competition to design a suitable plaque with a prize of £250, £12,220 in today's money. There were 800 entries from all over the empire, the dominions, and even from the troops on the Western Front. Mr. E. Carter Preston of Liverpool, England, was the eventual winner. The selected design was a 12-centimetre disc cast in bronze gunmetal, which incorporated the following in its design. 1. An image of Britannia with a lion representing strength. 2. Two dolphins representing Britain's sea power. 3. The emblem of Imperial Germany's eagle being torn to pieces by another lion. 4. Britannia is holding an oak's prey with leaves and acorns. 5. Beneath this was a rectangular tablet where the deceased individual's name was cast into the plaque. No rank was given, as it was intended to show equality in their sacrifice. 6. On the outer edge of the disc, the words, "He died for freedom and honour." 7. A scroll, 27 by 17 centimetres, 10.5 by 6¾ inches, made of slightly darkened parchment, headed by the Royal Coat of Arms, accompanied the plaque with a carefully chosen passage written in Old English script. This passage read, "He whom this scroll commemorates was numbered among those who at the call of king and country left all that was dear to them, endured hardness, faced danger, and finally passed out of sight of men by the path of duty and self-sacrifice, giving up their own lives that others may live in freedom. Let those who come after see to it that his name be not forgotten." Beneath this passage, written in the same style, was the name, rank, and service details of the deceased. To accompany the scroll, again in Old English script, a personal message from King George V. "I join with my grateful people in sending you this memorial of a brave life given for others in the Great War. George R.I." The plaques were packaged in stiff cardboard wrapping, folded like an envelope, and sent to the next of kin. Production of the plaques and scrolls, which was supposed to be financed by German reparation money, began in 1919 with approximately 1,150,000 issued. They commemorated those who fell between the 4th of August 1914 and 10th of January 1920 for home, Western Europe and the Dominions, whilst the final date for the other theatres of war or for those died of attributable causes was 30th of April 1920.
The Birth of the Land Army. Ron Freethy explains the role of women in wartime fighting for food. It has usually been understood that the Land Army was first set up in 1939-40, and amazement is often expressed with regard to how quickly and efficiently these hard-working lasses were trained and organised. In fact, there was a detailed plan which had been tried and tested during the First World War. All that had to be done was to follow the original system. This ended in 1918 and the next war began in 1939. When looked at with a historian's eye, there was hardly a gap between the two. The tried and tested Women's Land Army of the first conflict was simply reintroduced in the second. How and why did the Women's Land Army begin? The reason is easy to understand. At the start of 1914, young men volunteered to fight, and the slaughter in the trenches was such that more and more lads were needed. At that time, agriculture was not so mechanised as the case today and was very labour-intensive. Thousands of men were taken from the fields. The sound of skylarks ascending from the fields was replaced by the sound of shells descending on the trenches, and the sweet smell of hay was replaced by the stench of chlorine gas. The battle was not just in the trenches, but also on the high seas, where the German Kaiser was determined to take on the might of the British Navy. He knew that one way to win the war was to sink British merchant ships, bringing essential food to our island, and literally starve the nation into submission. During the Second World War, Hitler had the same aim. Britain's answer in both wars was also the same: grow more food at home. The British government, under the control of Lloyd George, soon realised that there was a major problem as more and more young farm workers were being killed on the Flanders battlefields. His answer was to recruit women. This was at the time when women did not even have the vote.
This is called The Sorrow of Youth About to Die. Among those for whom Churchill obtained a commission in the Royal Navy Volunteer Service was the poet Rupert Brooke, who sailed with the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force to the Dardanelles in February 1915. While in reserve on the Greek island of Skyros, awaiting orders to go into action, Brooke was bitten by a mosquito. The wound became infected, and later he died on board a French hospital ship in Skyros Bay on April the 23rd. He was 27 years old. Churchill later wrote an obituary of Brooke, and it was published in the Times 3 days later. This is what he wrote: "Rupert Brooke is dead. A telegram from the Admiral at Lemnos tells us that his life has closed at the moment when it seemed to have reached its springtime. A voice had become audible, a note that had been struck more true, more thrilling, more able to do justice to the nobility of our youth in arms, engaging in this present war, than any other. More able to express their thoughts of self-surrender, and with a power to carry comfort to those who watch them so intently from afar. The voice has been stilled. Only the echoes and memory remain, but they will linger." During the last few months of his life, months of preparation in gallant comradeship and open air, the poet soldier told with all the simple force of genius the sorrow of youth about to die, and the sure triumphant consolations of a sincere and valiant spirit. He expected to die. He was willing to die for the dear England whose beauty and majesty he knew, as were many of his comrades.
And now a poem by Rupert Brooke, The Soldier. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by sons of home. And think, this heart all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter, learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven.
Home fire is burning while your
Now I'm sitting next to Alan Bailey, who's going to share some of his childhood memories of World War II. Alan, as I understand it, you were born in Lincolnshire, and then in 1943, at the age of four, you went to live on your grandfather's farm. How did that come about?
Well, yes, that's right, Peter. I was born on the Leicestershire border with the nearest people to me in those years was 2 miles away, and that, he was another farmer. And I was born there at Wyville Lodge. And that was in 1939, just as war was breaking out. And then when I was 4 years old, my mother died. And as I was, there were four of us in the family, as I had two brothers and a sister, it was decided that we would be split up and sent away. That's probably a little bit strong to say that, but we were sent to live with other relatives. And I went from Wyville Lodge, the farm where I was born, down to Echo Farm, which was about 4 miles from Grantham, and that's where I came to live with Granny and Grandad.
So what sort of farm was it then, Alan?
It was a mixed farm. Grandfather, he looked after about it was a tenant farmer, and he looked after about 170 acres. It was arable, but he did have a milking herd of 12 Lincoln Reds, which I don't know whether you're aware, Peter, but Lincoln Reds are a very tall cow, a very tall beast, but very docile with huge horns.
Right. During the war years, farmers were encouraged to produce much of our food, weren't they? And in the 1940s, agriculture was still very labour-intensive.
It was.
And with so many young men called up to serve in the forces, how did your grandfather manage?
Well, it as you quite rightly say, it was a reserved occupation, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there wasn't the young men around to help on the farm. So what happened was the government gave permission from different areas of the British Isles, and certainly from Lincolnshire, it was a very intense farming county, that they could employ and have people live in, and it happened to be German prisoners of war, who I think they called trustees, but they were certainly young men that came to live on the farms in Lincolnshire that had been captured during the war. And that's how grandfather and my uncle, how they came to be able to carry on with the farm.
And did you get to know any of these prisoners?
I did. Yeah. At Echo Farm, we had two. There were actually two German prisoners of war, but the one I remember was a really... he seemed to me rather old, but I suppose at 4 years of age, you do seem rather old. But I now know that he was 18 years of age. Wow. And he had been taken captive from off a submarine that had been depth-charged. And he was a cook on board this submarine, and his name was Adolf, and he came to live at Echo Farm.
Right, OK. Now, some of my prevalent memories of the war years are of rationing. No sweets, little butter, eggs, meat, etc., and that horrible dried egg powder that we used to have. Did you have those restrictions on the farm?
Not at all.
Oh, you
no,
lucky
not
thing.
Not at all. Not at all. I can honestly say that we had I never wanted for anything. I suppose you could say that I was spoilt by grandmother, yeah. But we certainly still lived very well. We had our own pigs, of course. Two sows was run, and we had hens, which were White Leghorn Sussex, I remember, Rhode Island Reds, but we had sheep. I don't remember the sheep being killed, but I certainly remember the pigs being killed.
Right, right. Now, Lincolnshire. I always think of Lincolnshire as being flat Lincolnshire, and it's famous for its airfields, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Did you have many airfields around you, and what sort of memories of the RAF from those war years do you have?
We did. We had, where I was born at Wyvill Lodge, there was quite a big aerodrome called Saltby Aerodrome, and they were, it was manned by Australians, there were a few Americans, but I know that there were Australians and Canadians and some Polish people, and that was a bomber base, and the bombers went out from there. And what I vividly remember, before I left Wyvill Lodge, the poor chaps would come back from a bombing raid. They'd limped back in, some of them, onto Saltby Aerodrome. And after a debrief, quite a number of them would come, and they would literally lay down in Wyvill Lodge, in the farm, in the kitchen, in the living room, and they would just go to sleep. And I remember my father saying, poor boys, they really had to be able to have a rest and to get over the experience that they'd had. And I vividly remember them laying there, and we were told to keep quiet.
And of course the mortality rate amongst the bomber crews was quite high, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was. That's quite true, Peter. And certainly, I think I'm right in saying, aren't I, that the gunners particularly had terrible times.
Very vulnerable, weren't they?
If you lasted more than three sorties, was that it?
Something like that. Now, what from your abiding memories of the war years and those childhood years, what particular other things do you remember most strongly?
Well, I'll just say briefly, the vivid memory I had of Adolf, the young German at Echo Farm, I hadn't gone to school at this time, we would be in the hay fields, June, July, and collecting hay, and that was quite a hard job. And then there would be a thunderstorm blow up, and we was probably quite a long way from the farm. And poor Adolf would get into a ball, right down on the floor, into a ball, crouched, and he would cry and cry. And I remember my grandfather and my uncle and father, when he'd come down in those days, would put their arms round him and comfort him. And I used to think, a man crying. But I now know, of course, that he thought the terrible thunder that he was hearing was the depth charges coming back again. And I remember that vividly, them comforting him. I also remember the same thing again. As I said, he was a cook from off board a submarine. And every Friday, Adolf's job was to run the house. So the farm, my grandmother would go to Grantham on the bus, and she'd go at 9:30 in the morning and come back at 4:30 at night, and Adolf would run the farm. What memories of the wonderful things that he would cook. Granny was a good cook, but Adolf was particular, had wonderful things like strudel. I'd never heard of it until I was told what it was. And fritters. They were wonderful, wonderful memories.
And presumably Adolf was repatriated, was he?
He was. He went back, as far as I remember, and from what my youngest brother says, he was repatriated in 1947. So it was quite a while, but he went back repatriated, but it would be in those days in the Russian zone. So he went back there, and we didn't think that anything we'd ever hear any more again from him. But can I just say, later years, when when my father had retired, he'd moved down to Echo Farm when Grandad died. My father had retired and lived in the bungalow which had been built on the farm. And one Sunday afternoon, I wasn't there, but my youngest brother was with Father. One Sunday afternoon, a knock on the door. Father goes to the door, and there's a couple standing there. And they say, are you Bert Bailey? And he said, yes, I am. And they said, you farmed here at Echo Farm, did you? And he said, yes, I did. And they said, well, we've got some wonderful news for you. Father said, what's that? Didn't know what was going to happen or what was going to be said. And they said, we've been on holiday in Germany, and we got to the Berlin Wall, and we looked through and across no man's land, and there was people standing right over the other side, and there was a chap standing there shouting, are you British? Are you British? And they waved and shouted back, yes, we are. And he said, would you do me a favour? Would you find Bert Bailey, that lived at Echo Farm in Lincolnshire, just outside of Grantham? Would you go and tell him that Adolf is still alive? And that's what they came to tell my father. And my youngest brother, Jeff, says that Father stood there and he just wept and wept, and the lady held her arms round him, and it brought back, no doubt, such
memories,
terrific memories.
Yes, yes. I mean, I remember a visit to Berlin, and when the wall was still there, and it was certainly a formidable structure and very, very threatening and imposing. You mentioned the harvest.
Yes.
My memories of the harvest in those days are horses, wagons.
Yes, yeah? Indeed. Yeah. Indeed, yes.
Pitchforks.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yes. Yeah, they were indeed, yes. Yeah. The good old pitchfork. The sheaves were... I remember as a boy, it wouldn't be allowed today, but I was a little older now, a little older then, but I remember quite well my... my younger brother would ride the binder, I would drive the tractor, which was a Ford Major tractor in those days, and we'd binder acres of wheat and acres of barley, and I would be 10, my youngest brother would be 7, and that's what we'd do. And they were wonderful times. The people would come behind and stoop them up, and it was, to me, it was idyllic, absolutely idyllic.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing those memories with us, Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some things that I remember. I remember that I was 6.5 years old when the war with Germany was declared on September the 3rd, 1939. I remember sitting on my father's lap next to my mother, who had my 5-year-old sister on hers. What they said to us, I cannot recall, but I'm sure it was reassuring and in some ways quite exciting. A Morrison's indoor air raid shelter arrived, which, for the next 6 years, was to serve as our dining room table. Sticky tape crisscrossed the windows of several rooms, and black material was tacked into the back of curtains. I remember being delighted with my new bracelet with my name and identity number engraved on it. I still have it. There was some disruption of lessons at school. The first of the 6 schools that my sister Valerie and I were to attend during those 6 war years. I remember the air raid siren drill. Silence, line up and walk outside to the air raid shelters. Those shelters were rather fun for the pupils, but I doubt the teachers felt the same way. At home, We were always expected to be fast asleep by 9 p.m. so that our parents could listen undisturbed to the 9 o'clock news. Unless, that is, the siren sounded, in which case my sister and I were out of a bed in a flash. I remember so clearly struggling into my Winston Churchill-style green siren suit, the ancestor of today's onesie, perhaps, before running downstairs and leaping into the Morrison shelter. Our mother joined us, often accompanied by Jimmy, our large Persian tabby cat, for what became an enjoyable story-reading time. She got through all the Arthur Ransom books by the end of the war. My father, who, because of his engineering skills, was in a reserved occupation, was invariably doing fire-watching duty on the roof of the factory, which was then making parts for aircraft instead of vacuum cleaners. It was only when I left home that I fully appreciated how well my mother coped with the constraints imposed by food rationing and shortages. I remember her mixing up the dried egg and other ingredients for puddings, cakes and biscuits, inventing new casserole dishes to disguise the small meat content, and making endless jars of jam and bottling pounds of fruit from the garden. I can also remember the daily doses of cod liver oil and malt that my sister and I were subjected to. She found time to knit and to make clothes for us, to darn our socks and turn the collars and cuffs of my father's shirts, and at the same time joined the Women's Voluntary Service, looking very smart in her uniform. I remember longing for the time when I would be able to have a new jumper or a new dress from a shop. And of course, there were the precious sweet coupons for which Pearson children became responsible on their 8th birthday. The day I lost mine is imprinted on my memory. They never did turn up, and I had to walk 2 miles there and back to get some new ones. My sister strongly denied any implication in the case. From time to time, my mother, Valerie, and I, and Jimmy the cat, were sent by my father to stay in the country, presumably for some respite from the bombing in London as it spread further out into the suburbs. What I do remember very well are the places where we stayed. My great-uncle and aunt's big house and magical garden with a stream at the bottom of it, within walking distance of Windsor Great Park. I hated the tiny church school that we went to, and the fact that my great-aunt supported the war effort by insisting that we should use torn-up squares of newspaper instead of toilet paper. But the freedom from that air raid siren was bliss. I even got enrolled as a brownie in the park. It was a beautiful summer's day, and I can picture the scene now with a very proud me in the centre of it all. There were no clothing coupons to spare for a brownie uniform, but I was lent a proper brownie belt to wear over my dress. Sometime later, we stayed for several months in Bampton, where my mother had lived from the age of 5 until she was 21. The third school, about which I confess I remember very little, except that I kept slipping off the seat attached to the ancient iron-framed wooden desk. While in Bampton, my mother, plus cat, went home to have a few weeks with my father. Valerie and I stayed on a farm with a delightful family of 6, somewhere on the outskirts of Witney, and went very happily to school number 4. Our next move was to go back home. It was 1941, and the London Blitz was over, and my sister and I imagined that we would go back to our original school. Our parents had another idea, and off we went to Putney High School, evacuated to girls' boarding school in Caversham, near Reading. We stayed there until July 1943, when the high school moved back to Putney and Valerie and I were transferred to Wimbledon High School. For both of us, our sixth and actually our final school. Travelling by train to school was quite an adventure for us. There were hold-ups on the line and cancellations. Sometimes the siren went off in the middle of breakfast, but as soon as the all-clear went, we were off down to the station with never a backward glance. We took it all in our stride, as 9- and 10-year-olds do. It was only when I came across some letters that my mother had written to her sister that I appreciated the level of anxiety she experienced as we travelled between home and Wimbledon and back again. 1944 brought a new challenge in the shape of the flying bombs, or doodlebugs. I remember standing in the garden and watching the bombs pass overhead. Chug, chug, chug. And then silence, signalling the need to get back into the house and into that Morrison shelter. The summer term ended early that year because so many parents were loath to let their children travel to school. Mine were among them. June 1944 was the only time in the war that I remember being frightened. I couldn't cope with the sinister unpredictability of that weapon. The strange thing is that I have no further memories of that year following the flying bomb attacks, except that in August we had a lovely family holiday in Cornwall. I do, however, remember the last day of the war, May the 8th, 1945. I was ironing my guide uniform when my mother told me that she'd just heard on the wireless that the end of the war was about to be declared. I remember exactly what I said. Oh, good. They said at school that if it was declared today, we wouldn't have to go into school tomorrow. And presumably, I went on happily ironing my uniform. You know, I don't remember.
And now, I'm very pleased, but rather sad, to make a tribute to one of our listeners, Mr. Terry Harper. Terry responded to my plea for war memories from you, the listeners. One day, I got a telephone call. I answered it, and this rather excited, keen, enthusiastic man on the other end said, "Hello, I've got war memories for you. Would you like them? Would you like to hear them? Would you like to put them on your magazine about the war?" I said, "Yes, please. That would be wonderful." And so, we listened. He told us all sorts of exciting things. Ed Morris asked the questions, but the memories on it are Terry's memories. Soon after this recording, I heard that Terry Harper had passed away. But not, I believe, before he actually heard himself. So here are Terry's memories, his special memories of World War II.
So, well, Terry, thanks so much for sharing your reminiscences. Firstly, do you have any recollection when war was declared?
No, I don't. I can remember going on holiday in 1939 most distinctly. And then it was a sort of a blank until suddenly I sort of cottoned on. It must have been about well into the war that, you know, things were different then and things were happening and people were serious, and my father used to listen to the radio very, very sort of seriously. And my two brothers had gone off to be in the Navy. And it was, I just realised that things weren't the same. I was kept being told about this thing called peacetime. I said, well, why can't we go back to peacetime now? Why have we got to have wartime? But that was, I say, that must have been 2 or 3 years into the war, perhaps 2 years into the war. The actual declaration period of the phony war, I remember nothing about whatsoever. Well, I do remember, I should say, 1939, going on holiday in 39.
You mentioned that two of your brothers joined the Navy. Now, was that in peacetime, or were they conscripted?
They joined up and conscripted. Both of them went into the Fleet Air Arm and got up to all sorts of hijinks overseas. My brother was oldest brother was a pilot, and my younger brother was a navigator. And they were served. And my oldest brother served on the Atlantic convoys to on the Northern convoys to Murmansk, and my other brother was out in Trinidad and then in Ceylon. And eventually, he ended up in Tokyo just after the end of the war when Japan surrendered. My brother was out in Canada for a while, then he had a spell of, he was instructor, teaching young pilots to land on an aircraft carrier. Many of them didn't. Many of them ended up in the drink. They acquired various things as they went along, things that we hadn't seen. You should bring sort of tins of American cooking fat and things like that, and souvenirs from various places. I still got around, I still got one or two carved mementos that my brother brought back from Ceylon. They used to carve wood. It was in Trinidad too, and that was a very nice climb, and there were plenty of bananas. Just after the war, when bananas came in, I remember getting very excited. My brother saying, oh, I've seen enough of bananas to last me a lifetime. It's rather was off-putting, you know. These wonderful yellow things were suddenly available again. I'd only heard about bananas. I'd never seen one. And then they kind of started to come in. Generally speaking, if you could get anywhere near America, you could get hold of anything. Because all the goods were there. If you went to Canada, most of the American goods were available. You were able to sort of get all these wonderful things that we never saw in the shops over here. Brought over for us. And they used to come back with their trunks all packed full of goodies. It was interesting when they got home to be there when they opened their trunks to see what they'd got.
It must have been quite exciting.
It was very exciting, yes. I remember having a big tin of cooking fat all over to us, which was something that was scarce, and various things that were unobtainable in this country, you know. Just gave us a little treat at Christmas. And clothes, too. Some clothes were brought over, some of which I didn't like to wear because they were obviously American style. In fact, I had a coat brought over to me and I refused to wear it.
Do you believe your experiences during the war have had a long-term effect on you?
Oh, yes. Most biggest effect it's had on me is I never waste anything. I don't dream of not clearing my plate. I often eat more than perhaps I need should do, but I always reckon to clear my plate. It's just made me careful, and whether that's because of my wartime experience, I don't know. It certainly made me appreciate the value of things, and certainly made me very careful, and certainly not wasteful. I just absolutely throw up my hands in horror at all the junk, all the stuff that's thrown away now, all the junk food, and was just discarded, and of people piling their plates high and then leaving most of it. Absolutely horrifies me. Also, the war was the best of times and the worst of times. Obviously some very nasty, difficult moments and sad moments, but on the other hand, there were an awful lot of good times. An awful lot of laughs, you know. Comradeship was there, you know. It wasn't sort of isolation. People weren't isolated now. People talked to their neighbours. We made fun with the neighbours. We joined in everything. We shared our troubles, which is not so now.
Was Reading badly bombed?
No, it wasn't. It was rather lucky, actually. There were two isolated houses which were knocked out near the railway. And then one Wednesday afternoon, some German bombers unloaded their bombs on Reading. It was early closing. Unfortunately, one of the places they hit was the People's Pantry, which was a sort of state-run canteen, and quite a few people got killed there. Apart from that Wednesday afternoon raid, there was not much bombing at all. There was a large water tower near Reading, and the German planes used to use that as a turning point. They used to fly over, then when they got to the water tower, they used to turn north, head to the north, head to Coventry and places like that. We never actually had any bombings. No houses near me were damaged. I used to go to my uncle's out in the country and go and see great big bomb craters in the ground where a bomb had dropped in open fields where it's been unloaded by the German pilot. So that Wednesday afternoon when they bombed Reading, we were sat in a brick air raid shelter in the school grounds, the school playground. it was just normal. We heard the sirens go and the all clear sounded. Just, you know, it's the same sort of thing that happened another afternoon. When we came out and got home, we heard the news that the centre of Reading had been bombed. One of the big shops was destroyed and, as I say, the people's pantry, which was a lot of casualties, really, because it had to be full of people. But otherwise, the centre was empty because it was early closing day on a Wednesday. It was rather fortunate. Well, there was the absurdity of the buses in Reading. All the buses had destinations which were part of a district of the town. Some councillor decided that this was too informative to the enemy, so all the bus names were changed to the pubs that were nearest the end of the route. How they imagined that the Germans coming over would stand in bus queues, wondering which bus to catch, or where it was going to, I don't know. This was, the thing was completely balmy as far as we could see. It became a standing joke. Some council had actually thought of this. It had actually been put into place, which gave the impression to visitors of Reading that the place was just all pubs everywhere.
At this point, I would like to briefly describe a ceremony that took place in Arromanches, France, on the 6th of June 1994. During the D-Day 50th anniversary commemorations on that day, former Royal Marine Commando Patrick Churchill of Witney was made a Chevalier of the Legion d'Honneur by President Jacques Chirac of France. Mr. Churchill was one of only 14 people to receive this prestigious award. I'm now going to read some extracts from a book entitled D-Day, Minute by Minute, written by Jonathan Mayo and published by Short Books, who have kindly given us permission to reproduce these extracts. Tuesday, 6th of June, 1944. 5:15 a.m. The sun is beginning to rise, and 16 landing craft have stopped 5,000 yards out from the beach, codenamed Omaha. The Americans are about to launch their duplex drive tanks, Sherman tanks that are wrapped in canvas containing tubes of compressed air. The British Admiralty has declared them unseaworthy, but the Americans are convinced they will make it to the beach. By now, some of the waves are 6 feet high. British Commando Captain Logan Scott Bowden watches as one by one the 30-ton tanks travel for 100 yards and then sink like stones. Soon, 27 of the 32 tanks are at the bottom of the channel. Over 100 men have drowned, but still the tanks keep coming. Meanwhile, in a bunker overlooking the Normandy coast, Major Werner Pluskat of the newly arrived German 352nd Division is looking out to sea with his artillery binoculars. He literally steps back in amazement. The horizon is filled with ships. How could this fleet have got here without anyone knowing? Pluskat immediately calls an intelligence officer at divisional headquarters. There must be 10,000 ships out there. It's unbelievable, he cries. Look, Pluskat, are you really sure? The Americans and British together don't have that many ships. 5:30 a.m. News of the invasion has reached the Berghof, Adolf Hitler's headquarters in the Bavarian Alps. But no one wants to wake the Führer to tell him. 6 a.m. Dawn brings problems for the men of the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, who have parachuted down and are now guarding two captured bridges. German snipers have them in their sights. Even the men's first aid post is being targeted. When an orderly is hit in the chest, Medical Officer Dr. John Vaughan shakes his fist at the sniper and shouts, "This isn't cricket!" On the cliffs at the eastern end of Omaha Beach, Pluskat's bunker is being bombarded by Allied shells. All his German gunners are lying on the floor, covered in dust, and he is dazed and barely able to speak. The phone rings. It's divisional headquarters asking for updates. "Please give us an exact location of where the bombs are falling," says a voice Pluskat doesn't recognise. "For God's sake, they're falling all over. What do you expect me to do? Go out and measure the craters with a ruler?" he shouts back. 7:35 a.m. Wading through the sea at Omaha with the 12th Infantry Regiment is 25-year-old counterintelligence officer Jerome D. Salinger.
with him wrapped up securely in his backpack, are six chapters of a novel he's writing called The Catcher in the Rye. He has brought the manuscript with him as a lucky charm and as a reason to survive. 8:30 a.m. Albert Speer, Hitler's armaments minister, is at the Berghof. After an adjutant tells him about the invasion, he asks, "Has the Führer been woken up?" "No," says the adjutant. "He always receives the news after he's eaten breakfast." No one wants the responsibility of waking Hitler with news of what may be only a small-scale attack.
A Childhood Memory of D-Day. On the night of the 30th of May, 1944, 1 week before D-Day, I was an 8-year-old schoolboy living on the outskirts of the city of Truro in Cornwall when we were woken up by the wailing of the air raid sirens. My father bundled my brother and I, together with himself and my mother, into the Morrison shelter in our front room. The Morrison shelter, about the size of a large dining room table, with a sheet steel top, a steel frame, and steel mesh sides and floor. The shelters had been delivered to the houses in our road a few months earlier in kit form, and the men in the road had helped one another assemble them. As we crouched in the shelter, we could hear the noise of planes overhead, the thump of exploding bombs, accompanied by bright flashes in the sky. My dad said it was probably yet another raid on the port of Falmouth, just 5 miles away as the crow flies. Now, Falmouth was the first port of call for ships of the Atlantic convoys bringing in essential food and supplies from Canada and the United States. And any vessel damaged by enemy fire would limp into Falmouth for repairs before rejoining the convoys. Hence, the German desire to put the port out of action. The raid ended in the small hours of the 31st of May with a huge explosion and a bright orange glow in the sky. The all-clear sounded and we crawled back to bed for a few hours' sleep before rising to go to school, where the playground seemed full of small boys running about with their arms stretched out and making aeroplane noises. The talk was all about last night's raid. But as was the custom during the war, no details of that raid appeared in the press. Recently, with my childhood memory still vivid, I decided to delve into the archives to see if I could unearth any facts about that raid. And I discovered that it was the very last raid mounted on the UK by the Luftwaffe. For the remaining months of the war, they resorted to sending V1 and V2 explosive rockets, doodlebugs, across the Channel to London and the home counties. During that raid on Falmouth, 25 high-explosive bombs were dropped, together with 23 incendiary bombs and 20 butterfly bombs. A dockside hotel was demolished. A number of properties sustained substantial damage. 17 people were injured, but remarkably, only 3 people lost their lives. The vivid orange flash, I remembered, was caused by a direct hit on a 1 million-gallon oil storage tank, which burnt for 22 hours, and was marked by an act of outstanding bravery by an American Marine driving a bulldozer who dug out a channel to divert a river of blazing oil onto a piece of waste ground and away from a row of houses which it threatened to engulf, all the while being soaked with water by attending firemen. Now, the fact that this act of heroism was performed by an American was not unusual, because from late 1943 until D-Day, our part of Cornwall was inundated by United States troops using the Cornish beaches to rehearse for the D-Day landings. Truro Golf Course, about 400 yards from my home, became a tented village, and the main road into Truro, which ran across the end of our road, was lined with a parked convoy of jeeps, trucks and Bren gun carriers, which stretched for over a mile. And on our way home from school, we used to talk to the very friendly GIs, who gave us sweets and chewing gum, unheard of luxuries during the strict rationing of the war years. They told us about their homes in the USA, showed us pictures of their families. And then, on the morning of June the 5th, They'd all gone. It was as if a magic wand had been waved over the area. And then the next day, we heard on the radio that the D-Day landings had begun, which resulted in German surrender 10 months later. I also discovered from the archives that the Americans had built 2 stone quays on the banks of the deep waters of the Fowl Estuary, just 2 miles from my home. And on these quays, a workforce of 100 men assembled landing craft from parts brought in along a 2-mile road built by the GIs. The assembled landing craft were stocked with ammunition and supplies and moored at wooden jetties which projected into the estuary. During and after the D-Day landings, 875,000 troops, 150,000 vehicles and 570,000 tons of supplies were landed by the end of June. The GIs we had got to know left from the Fowl Estuary in those landing craft and landed on Omaha Beach, where they met some of the very fiercest opposition. Of the 3,000 men who were killed on D-Day, 800 of them were Americans who landed on Omaha Beach. And I wondered how many of them were those GIs who'd been so kind to us children. I also wondered if the outcome of D-Day may have been very different if those German planes on the 30th of May had made their bombing run along the Fowl Estuary instead of from out at sea. They'd have certainly spotted over 100 landing craft moored in the river, relayed that information back to Rommel, who was responsible for the position of the French coastal defences. Today, pleasure boats taking holidaymakers up the beautiful Fowl Estuary tie up at those quays built by the American soldiers, and passengers go ashore for a cream tea at the Riverside Cafe and Restaurant, which was the American HQ during the build-up to D-Day. And if they look carefully, they'll come across a granite pillar, on which is the following inscription: "To commemorate the D-Day embarkation, June 1944, from this spot, where units of the 29th Infantry Division of the US Army embarked for the Normandy landing on Omaha Beach on the morning of D-Day, June the 6th. We will remember them."
I'm here with my father, Dr. David Black, who was 99 last week. He was present at the D-Day landing. He was a surgeon lieutenant commander in the Navy for more than 6 years during the war. So, Dad, can you tell us your memories of D-Day as it was for you?
I embarked at Ryde on the Isle of Wight and we sailed to Sword Beach. I was in LST 427, which was a landing ship tank. We landed at H plus 2. This was part of a huge operation, and we started at 5 a.m. There were 6 LSTs sailing to land in Normandy to retrieve wounded soldiers. On each next tide, we sailed back to Portsmouth. We disembarked the tanks, vehicles, and took on board the wounded army personnel only if they had chance of survival. We did 3 or 4 trips over the next few days, rescuing more than 450 wounded. There were 2 doctors in my ship. The stern became an operating theatre. My job was to go round and assess the patients, make them more comfortable, and see if I thought they were still likely to survive. We were carrying the 51st Highland Light Infantry had labels on their foreheads to indicate what medication they had received.
Mm.
I heard there was a German doctor on board amongst the prisoners who was held on the upper deck in the rain. I asked him if he would come and help me tend to wounded Germans who were among the patients. "Certainly not," he said. "I'm here with my men, and here I stay."
So, Dad, can you tell me the story about the German colonel who was on the ship? The captain offered him the use of his day cabin?
There also was a captured colonel, German colonel, being offered the captain's day room.
Tell me the story about what he saw.
Oh, he stopped on the way to go into the cabin. The person taking him asked what was wrong, and he said, "Nothing's wrong, but I'm amazed at the Germanic script used for a saying of Goethe above the door, in der Welt dein Heim, in der Heim dein Welt." It would never have happened in Germany.
What's the translation?
Oh, in der Welt dein Heim, in the world your home, in the home your world.
Mm. So then what happened at Portsmouth each time you got back?
We offloaded all the patients into the care of nurses and doctors who were standing by. We needed to rest in the mess once the ship was reloaded and refueled.
Thank you very much, Dad. That's very special.
War memorials. Throughout this year, there have been many programmes and ceremonies looking back at aspects of both World War I and II. These have helped us to remember the dreadful events while giving many of us a greater insight and understanding of the conditions endured by so many. While the media has reminded us of these events, there is in many towns and villages a constant reminder of the men who died in both of the world wars, the local war memorial. Now, it is too easy to just be aware of these memorials, even if perhaps you've read the names on them. But how much do we know of the people themselves? The Carterton War Memorial lists 16 names, 8 from World War I, 7 from World War II, and 1 from Iraq in 2008. With help from the Carterton Family History Group, I would like to tell you briefly about the life of one of the names on the Carterton War Memorial. Albert William Rose. Thomas Rose was born in 1875 in Hatton and Buckinghamshire. He was a hay binder, later called a hay tier, but otherwise an agricultural labourer. Martha Jean Carr was born in Malton, Yorkshire in 1872 and had moved to Marsh Baldon in Oxfordshire, probably to find work. They married in the latter part of 1895 and have two sons, Albert William, born in 1897, and Arthur, born in 1900. They moved to Bushy Ground, Minster Lovell, and had three more children, Archie, born 1902, Aidan, born 1904, and Albury, 1905. Albert William joined the army in 1914 and was just 17 when war was declared. He joined the Machine Gun Corps, which was only formed in 1915 when heavy machine guns and tanks were first used. According to the family, his younger brother Arthur also joined up after claiming to be older than he was. They were together in the trenches in France in 1917 when they were ordered to go to the front. But as they moved out, Albert was shot. Arthur wanted to go back to see if his brother was badly hurt, but was ordered to go forward by a sergeant. It was much later on his return to the trenches that Arthur was told that his brother was dead. Albert William was just 20 years old and is buried in the Unicorn Cemetery while his brother survived and returned home safely. There are similar stories behind all of the names listed, with some being more locally connected than others. Whatever their fate, it pays us to remember that there was so much more to the person than just a name.
Lawrence Binion, 1869 to 1943. Lawrence Binion was keeper of prints and drawings at the British Museum, scholar of British, Japanese and Persian art, a Red Cross volunteer in a military hospital at the Western Front, champion of Isaac Rosenberg's poetry during the 1920s, Norton Professor at Harvard in the early 1930s, author of more than a dozen volumes of poetry, translator of the Divine Comedy, and friend of Ezra Pound, Walter Sickert, Lucien Pissarro, Edmond Dulac, and countless other literary and artistic figures of the day. He wrote many poems of the war, as well as a prose account of wartime Red Cross activity, entitled For Dauntless France in 1918. Yet despite these accomplishments, he is now best known as the author of a single poem, quoted round the world each year on Remembrance Day, For the Fallen. The fourth stanza is read and memorized, chiseled on tombstones, and recited as the Ode of Remembrance across much of the English-speaking world. To end our magazine, Ode to Remembrance will now be read for us by our chairman, Mr. Peter Brading.
They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.